Well, hey, everybody, I'm Dan Dietrich, and this is the Common Good Podcast brought to you by Vote Common Good. So glad you're with us. We've got a great show for you today. Sarah McCammon of NPR is with us. She sat down with Doug Padgett to talk about her new book, The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And if you're a regular listener to the Vote Common Good podcast and connected to our work, there's a decent chance that this book is really going to resonate with you. A lot of us have had similar experiences. We grew up in the church, and then for any number of reasons found ourselves saying, this doesn't work for me. So Sarah tells a bit of her story in the book, as well as interviews others about their reasons for leaving the church. Really great interview. We'll get into it in just a minute. But we also want to tell you what's going on in the Vote Common Good world. We've got a couple trips coming up. If you weren't aware, there's a solar eclipse happening in just a couple weeks. April 7th to the 9th, Vote Common Good is going to be heading down to Eagle Pass, Texas, which will be the first place in the United States where the eclipse will be visible. And so we're doing a little science-y field trip with astrophysicist Paul Wallace. We'll be down at the border and experiencing this eclipse and talking about science. Right after that, we're going to have a couple border experiences, April 9th through the 12th in Texas and Mexico, and then April 19th through the 22nd in Arizona and Mexico. And these are experience trips. We're going down to the border and connecting with groups and organizations and friends that we made along our cycling trip along the U.S.-Mexico border. So you're going to get to meet incredible people doing incredible work and really get a sense for what the border situation is. Get beyond the headlines and the sound bites and experience for yourself what's going on at the southern border. You can find details about those trips and a lot more at votecommongood.com. But now we want to dive into this conversation between Doug Padgett and Sarah McCammon on her book, The Exvangelicals. Enjoy.
All right. Well, hey, Sarah, so glad to have you on the podcast and live stream today. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
All right. So The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving White Evangelical Church is a great title and a great topic. And as we said in the intro to this, something you know about personally. So this book is part memoir, part your story, and part interviews with other people about something important happening in our society. At least that's the way I read it. Is that how you would think of it?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I had sort of a kernel of an idea for this book for a long time. And, you know, really, I mean, throughout my 20s and 30s, I'm in my early 40s now, I was in a process that I now recognize was what people call deconstruction. And I didn't really have a language for it. I didn't have a community for it. I was just kind of trying to figure out how to make sense of, you know, the community I came from and the things I was taught to believe, many of which were and still are dear to me, but other things that didn't really add up or didn't feel like they resonated with who I wanted to be in my own adult life. And so, you know, I think that this is a book that a lot of people will relate to in one way or another, because we all kind of have to make sense of the community we came from, the family we came from, whatever that was, and sort of take the good and the bad and decide who we want to be in our own lives. But I felt like there was something specific going on with evangelicals, because evangelicalism, as I write, is such a massive subculture. You know, when I was growing up in it, I thought we were sort of this little tiny oppressed minority. I had no idea really how many people were evangelical in some sense, or how influential this movement was or would become. I just knew that, you know, we believed we had the good news and we were supposed to share it. And that meant a whole lot of things. And then as I got older, and I have always sort of thought about these themes, I kind of noticed that there were more and more people talking about these experiences and talking about them on podcasts and on social media in ways that felt really resonant for me. And, you know, as a journalist, anytime you kind of see something happening, you see sort of a trend or a conversation around something emerging, you go, well, that might be a story. And so I thought, that's a story that I want to tell, but in conversation with my own, both because I think as it's not something we get to do a lot as journalists. We usually have to, we want to keep ourselves out of it as much as possible, out of the story. But also I think when you do know something deeply, that can add to the conversation in a meaningful way. And so that was what I really, you know, hope to do.
When you were growing up, it was in Missouri, is that right? And you were a churchgoer?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can tell you a little bit about that church if you want me to.
Yeah, please. Yeah, I'd love to hear all about it.
So, as you know, evangelicalism is a big umbrella term, and people debate what it means, and pollsters and sociologists and historians struggle sometimes to categorize it, but I'm pretty much talking about conservative Protestantism, theologically conservative Protestantism. That's what the world I grew up in, and I grew up in different parts of it. I mean, I went to a charismatic church that was non-denominational, so not affiliated with a particular church organization, not Baptist, not Methodist, nothing like that. And when I say charismatic, as you know, but I know not everybody is as big of nerds as we are about religion, Doug. So I mean, you know, raising hands, speaking in tongues, believing in miracles, having this really intense personal relationship with God, which is a feature of evangelicalism too, but I would say even in possibly a more intense way in charismatic circles. So that was my church. I went to a Christian school as well, which was also very theologically conservative, but was more in the closer to sort of the fundamentalist side of the spectrum. Sometimes people talk about evangelicalism and fundamentalism as two distinct movements, but I think they're really overlapping in huge ways. And so it was a little more conservative, a little more strict, but we fundamentally believed all the same things. And, you know, and then I went to college and yet another kind of subsect, I guess you could say, of evangelicalism, because as I've said, it's just such a massive movement. But there are certain things that I think hold everyone fundamentally together, a common set of beliefs.
And this was in the late 1980s and 1990s, right? When you were a kid, it's in church and teenager through the 1990s. Right. Is that right?
Yeah. And I was born in 81. So beginning of the Reagan era. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was a particular era of evangelicalism, sort of in the 80s and 90s. There was a version of it. It to a lot of people's surprise, it looks really different now to some people, and others, it's like, no, it's kind of the same thing, right? There's been some changes. Were you a real church kid as well? Like, was church meaningful to you? Did you go to youth group and all that and camp and those kinds of things?
For sure. We were in church every Sunday. We lived in, our church was like in a suburb. So Kansas City, a lot of people may know, is actually in Missouri. And then there's a suburb called Kansas City, Kansas too. And our church was across the state line in another suburb farther out. So we really only went to services most of the time on Sunday mornings. But we'd sometimes go to other events during different times in the week. And then of course, being in Christian school, we had a lot of activities around that conservative Christian community. And I went to church camp, youth group camp. When I did get into the youth group age, I'd go on most Wednesday nights, would drive out to youth group at the church or at a friend's house. And so, yeah, it was a big part of my life. And really my whole world was in some way, almost entirely other evangelical Christians. Church, school, and home was kind of my entire world.
Yeah, I recognize that world where I was a youth pastor, not in the charismatic tradition, but in that kind of non-denominational evangelical world during that period of time, you know, from the late 80s through working in big churches. And there was a sense of evangelicalism then, that at least the world I was in, you could avoid the political side of it. People cared about certain issues and differed, but, you know, you were still, you know, 10 or 15 years past an evangelical Democrat who was a president. And there was just, I don't know, it was kind of a mix of people. But through the 1990s, it felt like that started to sort differently. You know, I don't know if it was just the political climate or what was going on, but it felt like, wow, a high school kid in 1988 could feel really different than a high school kid in 1998. When it came to how they saw themselves as an evangelical presenting themselves to the world. Do you feel that way? Do you think like you were part of your teenage years were right in a crucible period where there was really a shift happening in the consciousness of what it meant to be evangelical and as a teenager in America?
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. It's probably true. I mean, I remember my church being involved in like anti-abortion activism, I think from a pretty young age, Walks for Life and things like that. But I think that, that, yeah, about the time I was in high school. So I was 17 in 1998 when the Clinton scandal, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal happened. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. And so I was coming, I was coming online and becoming aware of politics at the time that, you know, the Republican Revolution in the House happened and then the Clinton presidency. And I remember that, you know, James Dobson, who was somebody that when I was, you know, in the 80s as a child, and I read about this as well, had been on our radio telling stories about, you know, God's love for families and, you know, giving advice about parenting and bringing people on his radio show, talking about usually not political topics from what I remember as a smaller child. But then I remember in 1996, I remember very well when I was 15, James Dobson sort of leaning into the Republican Party and saying, you know, you need to essentially pick one of us or somebody who's more religiously and socially conservative, and, you know, threatening to leave the party over the nomination of Bob Dole. And so, you know, I remember just kind of being aware of that and trying to understand what was going on a little bit. And then, you know, I graduated from college in 2003 and became a journalist and tried not to think too much about evangelical politics. I mean, at the beginning of my career, I was covering agriculture in Nebraska, and I was happy to have a break from all of that. Although I found myself at times, you know, like doing science stories that would intersect with something about evolution and going, oh my gosh, I guess I was taught this isn't real, and I need to figure out, you know, what I think and figure out what I've missed, essentially. So, you know, to answer your original question, like I'm not a historian, but I think that what you've said just, you know, aligns with the history I've read and some of the historians I've cited, that, yeah, there was an intensification, I think is maybe the best word, of a political project that began around the time that Reagan took office in the early 80s. And of course, culminated with the election of Donald Trump in 2016.
Yeah. And there was all that talk back in that period of time with evangelicals that, like, the church was the hope of the world, right? That kind of language was really around, and that it was the revolution of a heart that was going to matter. And then more progressive Christians, or, you know, people from other political swipes, they would talk about systemic issues, and evangelicals would talk about personal issues, you know, my heart, Christ, right, home kind of stuff, right? Like, there was this big debate, and that just feels like so long ago, right? To some of us who've experienced different versions of the evangelical world. Well, what were your parents up to then? Like, what did you, growing up, what were they church going people? Were they heavily involved in all of this? Were you the religious one in the family, or were they?
No,
also
there? I mean, this was absolutely, they were there. And they were very influenced. I think, I mean, from my perspective, a lot of what happened is that some of the loudest voices were the voices that had a specific political agenda, which may or may not have had anything to do with the original meaning of Christianity. But for my parents, you know, neither of them had grown up evangelical. My father grew up in a mostly secular household. My mom in a, you know, pretty conservative Lutheran household, which probably would be evangelical today, but it was kind of pretty much everybody on her side of the family was descended from German immigrants who'd moved to the Midwest and farmed, and they were all Lutheran because everybody was Lutheran. And not to say it wasn't a big part of their lives, but it wasn't an ideology in the way that it seems to be now for a lot of people. And so I remember her talking, and I touch on this in the book, about this sort of division, you know, the paradigm that I was presented with was sort of this division between true believers in Jesus and nominal Christians, you know, people who were Christians in name only. And I, you know, I grew up thinking that, I think at one time I really thought that the word nominal was almost like the word mainline, like that was the mainline Protestant, like you just called those just were nominal Christians. That's what you called them. I didn't realize it was a, more of a commentary on their sincerity. And I, you know, we didn't really talk about other branches of Christianity as if they were legitimate, you know, so Catholicism was very questionable. Mainline Protestantism was questionable. You know, I remember my parents talking about having this, like, really, for them, really meaningful encounter with Jesus. Like, they felt like they had been saved and saved from things in their lives that, you know, in retrospect, they didn't feel they were going the right direction for various reasons. And I don't, you know, I just want to say, I try to be judicious about what I say about them. I had to talk about them to talk about myself and my own history, because my understanding of the faith came first from them. But, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but these are the impressions I was left with growing up about their own personal journey. And I do know that they felt like meeting Jesus in this particular way, you know, kind of on the heels of the Jesus movement in the 70s, it really transformed their lives and it made them better people. And they felt like they found meaning and purpose and salvation, literally. Right. So that was what they wanted to hand down to me.
What did they do for work? Were they businessy types? What was their thing?
My mom was a homemaker, and my dad has worked in communications and, you know, various types of communications for a while. He now works in Christian media. I'll just leave it at that, if that's okay.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So as a kid, you were like just in normal sort of suburban life, living the dream of an evangelical kid.
Yeah. I mean, we were middle class, upper middle class, I would say. You know, to me, it was just normal that my mom stayed home. That was what women were supposed to do. And I mean, I was encouraged to go to college, and I did go to Christian college. But from a young age, I was told that, you know, quoted Bible verses about women being keepers at home. And there was very much the vision of my life that I think I was given and that was modeled for me by the women around me was one where you would marry a Christian man, you would have hopefully several children, and you would raise them up to be in the faith just like I was. Yeah. So it was, you know, it was a really, of course, I talk about some of the pain points and tension points with evangelicalism and, you know, that and why I felt like I had to leave and why a lot of people feel they have to leave. But, you know, I had a very privileged upbringing, I'll be honest, I did. And I was fortunate to have the material comforts that, you know, everything that we needed. What we weren't wealthy was just one income, but the fact that we were able to exist in that way, you know, was a privilege. I thought of it as normal and as expected, but you know, I recognize now that we were fortunate in that regard. And everything kind of, like I said, revolved around church and school and trying to live in the way that we thought God wanted us to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reason I think these histories are so valuable for people as they think about this is because when people go through changes like you have, and many people who would identify as previously evangelical or ex-evangelical from the title of your book, and that kind of movement of ex-evangelicals, oftentimes it's an internal struggle that people are having, right? It's not as if they're oftentimes leaving that religious framework is also commentary on their family and on their growing up, and people have a very hard time separating out these issues, you know, where people are like, growing up, things were good for me and I liked all of this, but I'm not staying there. And oftentimes the people in your past don't understand what you're doing. They're like, why are you because in their minds that this all was part and parcel, like, we're following God now, and so we're being rewarded, and we're living in this good life, right? And this is we're living the American dream. Why are you throwing it away? And what's happening? And there becomes this struggle that a lot of people in their 20s and 30s have a hard time reconciling, because it's hard to pinpoint where it went differently than people wanted it to. You know, and you're not sure if they changed or you changed, all that kind of thing. Was that your experience? And do you find that with people that you talk to in this movement as well?
For sure. And I mean, I think things can be more than one thing, right? I interviewed my little brother for the book. He said something like that, like, you know, on the whole, I had this really good life, but there was also like all of this fear, this kind of like lurking fear through so much of it. And I think for me, that was one of the biggest things that I remember, you know, sadly, is fear of believing the wrong thing, fear of not believing fervently enough. I mean, and I was trying, I'm telling you, I was trying. I would pray, you know, especially being charismatic, you know, I worried that because I couldn't speak in tongues, you know, with a spiritual language like the Bible talks about, I tried to do that, but it never felt like it was quite happening for me. And I'd see people in my church, you know, speaking in these words that I didn't understand. And they would say it was a language from God. And I wanted to have that too, because that was sort of, I thought, a sign of God's favor. And it, you know, I would remember being in my room and praying for that and it not happening. And, you know, there were so many times that I felt I would have these questions. Like I would, as I got older, you know, realizing that some of the things we believed didn't align with, you know, like what most scientists believed, or, meeting people who believe different, were of different faiths. And I would struggle with that. And I would feel like something was maybe wrong with me. And I would be afraid that I was getting it all wrong, that God was angry with me, that, that I wasn't doing the right things with my life, because we were so concerned with getting it right, you know, believing the right things and doing the right things. And I never felt like I was. It was very hard to feel like I was measuring up. And there was a lot of just sort of fear for the world, you know, like fear of God's wrath for the whole world. And you know, a big character in my book is my grandfather, who was not a Christian and was somebody that we prayed for pretty much daily for his salvation. And, you know, I would lie in bed just worrying about him terribly. And you know, I think maybe it was different for my parents, right? Because they, whatever it was that happened for them, obviously it was really meaningful. And I think they chose this type of faith for themselves. And, you know, I remember asking my mom one time about hell and like what she thought it was really like. And she said, I hadn't thought about it that much. I just didn't give it that much thought, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I quote my brother in the book saying, you know, he had similar feelings. Like he would be swimming at swim team and just have these like images in his mind of like a grandfather burning in hell. And it was terrifying. And it was, you know, I mean, I remember many sleepless nights. And I think that that is a common experience for a lot of evangelical kids. And I don't know why it's different for parents, or I don't really know where the disconnect is. But along with the fear, or along with the good stuff, you know, the summer camps and the family vacations and the relatively comfortable life, there was a lot of kind of just existential dread that I remember. And I think part of leaving was about wanting to get away from that and about wanting to be allowed to be okay with people who were different from me, you know, and not have to try to make them think like me, because that started to feel really impossible and really kind of ugly for me.
Mm-hmm. The subtitle of your book is Loving, Living, and Leaving the Evangelical Church. So I kind of want to talk about all of that, you know, your own experience that was so good that you were living this thing out. And then there's these pieces that don't fit. And for a lot of evangelicals, you know, I've spent a lot of my life with people, because I wasn't raised in evangelicalism or religion at all. So I got into it as a teenager. So probably a story closer to your parents. And I never bought into a lot of that stuff. I never thought hell was a thing like people were describing, and never thought about God as the thing we fear. God was the salvation from the things we feared. I mean, just kind of a different orientation. But man, a lot of people really saw their torment as a child being told things about, you know, the God of the universe being opposed to people and wanting to threaten them. And that's really traumatic to people as kids. I mean, I've gotten to the point, like, we shouldn't be telling kids stuff that is meant for adults only. Like, it traumatizes children. And if you have a theology of that stuff, which frankly, you just shouldn't have a theology of hell like that. Like, Dante's Inferno is not the thing you should be telling kids about, which most people sort of do. It's not kid material. You know, the stuff is not, but then, you know, even try to tell some stories, and I, you know, my rabbi friends are the same way. They're like, got some stuff in the, you know, in the Hebrew scriptures. It's a little tough to tell kids about, you know. You can wrap it up in a rainbow and a Noah's Ark, but, you know, planetary floods in which everyone dies is just a tough topic, right? So if we're going to, you know, have a Bible story about that, we better make it age appropriate. And it gets really weird and whips up kids and makes them have a difficult time. And a lot of people never shake it. And one of the things I've run into, Sarah, I'm wondering if you've run into it, is there's a lot of people who feel like what they heard when they were children in evangelical churches, kind of a scared child version, maybe even a teenage mm-hmm. version. They feel like that is really true Christianity, and they don't want anything to do with it anymore. And other mm-hmm. people, when they hear it, they're like, wow, I was really given a false story about what Christianity is when I was a kid. And I want to live in the more accurate or true or better version of that story, the one that, you know, I experienced in the Bible. And there kind of becomes these two groups in some ways, right? Those who are like, well, I know you liberals are out there saying there's all this other Christian stuff that people are up to, and there's a way to talk about God as, you know, the course of all being and the ultimate love of all the universe and all that. But Christianity really teaches an angry God that wants to get the people that are his enemies, and I don't want anything to do with that. Do you know what I'm, do you see what I'm getting at? And do you hear
yeah.
that?
Oh, yeah.
I can't shake it, the version of Christianity they were taught when they were kids, and they're pretty sure that's the real thing. If you're going to be Christian, you need to believe that stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that advocates of that point of view point to, you know, they make their argument from Christian, you know, they point to certain verses in the Bible. They point to certain parts of the Christian historical tradition. And I get that argument, but you know, the Christian tradition isn't just one tradition, and it's big and vast. And I think, you know, part of my deconstruction, if you want to use that word, was learning more about just kind of how it all came together, both from, you know, the early church fathers, who, like, just the fact that they were fathers is one piece of the problem for me. Like, there were voices that were systematically excluded, and so maybe we'd have a different understanding of what Jesus taught if we had included other voices, but that's just one piece of it. But just like understanding how the sausage was made, you know, like where the Bible came from, all of the fights that happened in the first centuries of the Christian church, like what we think of as Christianity could be very different. And it is. I mean, there are so many different, you could say, Christianities. And I think that was helpful to me as I was trying to sort of loosen the grip of the type of Christianity that I was raised with, and the fear part of it. But I think part of the reason people think that are falling into that first group you described, Doug, of saying that this is the real Christianity, is because we were told that it was. I mean, when I was talking about mainline Protestants, I mean, many of whom are liberal Protestants, and I'm talking mostly theologically here, as well as sometimes politically, but I'm primarily talking about theological liberalism. I mean, I was told that that wasn't true Christianity, that was mm-hmm. like an attempt to sort of conform to the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're almost inoculated in a lot of evangelical communities as a child. You're kind of intentionally inoculated against other forms of Christian thought, and certainly against any kind of counterargument to Christian thought, at least of the kind that I was being taught.
Yeah, for sure. When someone makes the changes that you've made in their own minds, in their own hearts, in their behaviors, there is this very real sense that I'm doing something wrong. Like I have to break the rules that I've kept up until now. Do you remember that point for you when you, or that season of life when you're like, okay, I am now going to think a thought differently, or I'm going to say something I wouldn't have said or not say something? Do you remember that period of time and what that was like as you were ex-evangelicaling yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's something a lot of people some of the people I talked to for the book describe as well, just this feeling like, I think one person said, do I have permission to think this thought or to ask this question? And I certainly felt that. I think I went through a stage where I swore kind of a lot because it was like a way of saying, I don't have to be bound by these rules. I try to do that less now because I just think it's not flattering, but, you know, you're sort of trying out these things. Like, I mean, even just going to a party and drinking alcohol kind of felt really risky for a while. And again, that's one of those things that, like, today over 40, I'm like, I might have a drink with dinner, but I have to take an Advil. You know, it's like it's an evolution. But yes, I mean, I think behaviors, thoughts, questions, all kinds of things were taboo, and sort of dipping your toe into the water of exploring them or trying them out is very scary. And some of the scariest things are just in your own mind. Because there is a sense, as Stephanie Stalvey, who's an artist I quote early in the book, there's a sense that if you kind of pull at a thread, everything is going to unravel. And for some people, it really does, you know, so it can be a legitimate fear. But I also think that if you have a question that is vexing you and you can't seem to avoid or look past, trying to avoid or look past it is just not going to, it's not going to work. And I think that one of the things that we were taught in Christianity is to seek truth. And sometimes that search for truth leads you to change your mind about some things.
When people leave the evangelical church, there's often a price they pay. They lose their friendships, you know, especially people like you, or I also went to a Christian college, and you're like, yeah, like my college friends, I feel a separation. And for some people, they feel that from their own families and from the church they grew up in, and they can be, it can be super lonely. What did you find in your research about how hard it is for people to make that shift? Because a lot of people tell us in the work we do, you know, of helping people who are evangelical to expand their horizons, we try to explain how hard it is and the social cost that people pay, and, mm-hmm. and how painful it can be socially to feel alone and to feel at odds and to feel out. You just, it's like you don't have anywhere to go, you know, because you don't know this other world. I have a lot of friends who were raised in more, even more conservative spaces than you're describing and that I knew. But they're like, I didn't even know the music or movies. So I felt totally out of things. You know, people laughed at things I didn't understand, and they would talk about topics that I didn't know. Did you find that in the research that you were doing, that the social cost of someone to leave this identity of being evangelical was really a high price to pay?
Oh, for sure. And I think that's a really common experience. I mean, I relate to that experience to an extent. Like I wasn't completely cut off from pop culture, but it was heavily restricted. And you're right, some people have almost no exposure to it. And so there are those gaps in your understanding and knowledge of sort of the quote unquote real world. And then there's the sense of, it can feel sometimes like your connections to the evangelical world are very conditional. And I think that's partly because when someone leaves, for people who are very entrenched in that community, it can be scary for them and alarming for them that someone they know is leaving. You know, I've certainly had not a lot, actually probably less people than you'd think, but I've had friends reach out and say, you know, can we talk about this? And I know that's a really common experience when people start posting things on Facebook or just stop going to church. You know, people reach out and they want to intervene, and it comes from a place of concern for their well-being. And I get that, but it can also feel, really feel like there's a consequence for sort of stepping out and creating your own space. And a sense, there can be a sense of not, like you said, not knowing where to go. You know, the people I talked to for the book dealt with that in a lot of different ways. And I described some of those. I mean, for some people it's about not having certain conversations with family members, you know, maybe setting really clear boundaries, which may be explicit or they may be implicit, but they exist. You know, there are certain things we're just not going to talk about. That doesn't work for everybody. And it takes both sides to agree to respect those boundaries for that to work. There are other people who have found, you know, that to really painful separations. I mean, I quote a pastor, sort of an ex-evangelical pastor, later in the book, whose church I visited in Nashville. And he said he doesn't really talk to his parents about what he does for a living. You know, they just kind of agree not to talk about it. And I think for a lot of people, that's a pretty common experience to one degree or another. In order to preserve the relationship, there are certain things that are off limits. And that is, that's true for me to some extent. And it's better than nothing, I think, for a lot of folks, but it's also painful because it feels like you're not fully known or accepted by people that you'd like to know and accept you. But then there's also the process sometimes of forming new communities and finding those people and spaces, and that may be through a different religious community or it may be through something entirely different. But finding a new place to hopefully find connection and to flourish.
It feels really different for Catholics, and I've spent a lot of time with Catholics. It kind of feels like Catholics are like, yeah, I don't practice my Catholicism anymore, and that's hard for my parents, and I don't go, and I went to Catholic school, but I don't do that anymore. But I'm kind of still Catholic, but not, I don't really do it, you know? It feels different for evangelicals. Like, I don't ever hear evangelicals be like, hey, I'm just not a practicing evangelical anymore.
It's
a different identity. You know what I mean? And for the same reasons my Catholic friends say the same stuff about why they're not there, the political stuff, the power stuff, the abuse, the theology. It's just one for one. And then one group says, but you know, I'm still Catholic. And the evangelicals are like, nope, not evangelical or Christian anymore. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, I've been thinking more about that recently, so I don't really have my own thoughts on it.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because this is something I have been thinking about for like a decade or more. Like, and I can't speak to what it's like to be a Catholic or ex-Catholic or, you know, cradle Catholic or whatever the case may be, lapsed, some people say. But I think that's right. I mean, just based on what I've observed, I think there is more of a category for, you know, I was baptized in the Catholic Church and it's part of my community and it's sort of a, it's a cultural thing, but it's not something I necessarily believe all of, but maybe I show up for big holidays. I think in the evangelical spaces I grew up in, it was like that kind of religiosity was sometimes highlighted in a negative way. I mean, it was people who only went to church on holidays were almost people we needed to reach and recruit and witness to. You know, there was a sense that they weren't truly saved. We'd hear language like that. I mean, did you hear language like that or in the churches?
Oh my gosh. And I was in the big, I was in like the big church movement. And I remember being, I feel really comfortable naming names. So I was at a, with a bunch of leaders of a church called Willow Creek, which was a big church in the Chicago, Illinois area. And I remember talking with some of their leaders about all the stuff we were working on together. And I said, hey, how many of the people in your church, this evangelical church here, were Catholics? And they're like, oh, about 80% of them. Like, so basically you are a discipleship project for former Catholics. They're like, yeah, that's kind of, we just call it evangelism, you know, and we're in Minnesota where I was and still am. It was like mostly Lutherans and Catholics that stopped being Lutherans and Catholics and they became evangelicals. Like that was the story of so many people, like raised religiously, but it didn't mean anything. But this church kind of, I'm back at my faith, you know, and they called them new converts in a really curious way. Like, okay. Yeah, no, that was very, that narrative was very strong. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there are a couple of different reasons for it. Like one is that it created a whole pool of people who were potential converts. So that was convenient. And also, I mean, and we could probably talk about this for an hour, but I'll just say briefly, I think that the fact that, evangelicalism by and large is not sacramental and it's not liturgical, is a piece of the reason for that. Because if you have a practice, you can go to a place and do, you know, you cross yourself, you repeat the liturgy, then that's sort of like a thing you can do with your body that shows that you're a Catholic or a Christian. Whereas for evangelicals, there's so much emphasis on believing, feeling, the personal relationship with Jesus. And so, I mean, that was something I struggled with. You know, I went through, I didn't even write about this in the book because it felt like a side thing, but I went through a whole phase in college where I was like really studying Catholicism. And I wound up kind of landing for a while in Episcopalianism. When I go to a Christian church, that's usually where I go. Because I felt like it meant something to me. I knew it meant something to me, but I felt like I didn't always feel inside my heart or believe in my mind what I was supposed to. And so having a thing I could just go do was like really helpful for me. And that's, I mean, that's a really big difference. And so I think, I wonder sometimes if that's part of why evangelicalism emphasizes like believing and I mean, there's no way to participate other than just to like to show up and put yourself in a chair. But I think that has changed somewhat too, you know, since the pandemic and there are other ways now I mean, like I keep coming back to this, but there are other ways to connect with spirituality online that are really different than it used to be. But yeah, I think you're right about that. And it's something I think about a lot.
Yeah, I do too. Because, you know, we're all navigating what we mean by our pasts and our histories and our religion. And look, all of us, any spiritual teacher will remind us, we should all keep growing. And that's one of the limitations in the evangelical church. And I've been talking to my evangelical, you know, cohorts about this stuff for years. Like, I think you all have a system in evangelicalism that puts a cap on spiritual growth. You can't grow any more than what you're allowed to inside the system. And that's a real problem, you know, something that should be figured out. So that's definitely an issue. Now, I would imagine this book is going to be helpful for people who say, Sarah, your story matches mine, and it is so helpful to see it talked about like this with a journalist approach and a personal understanding. Do you also hope it's going to be helpful for the many people in our society who don't understand evangelicals at all and are freaked out by them? Another, I don't know what the numbers you use, but 70 to 100 million people that might be in that in that cohort somehow, you know, or 50 to 100 million, whatever it is, it's a lot of people with a lot of influence in a lot of spaces in America. And man, the number of people that I talk to or hear in the media that just have no experience with evangelicals or think they don't. I often joke though, when people are like, I don't know any evangelicals. I'm like, it's like my friends who say, I don't have any gay friends. You totally have evangelical.
You definitely
You've never asked. But there is really a missing piece. And I watch, you know, in media and so on, people try to grasp what evangelicals are, and the misunderstandings are severe. So anything you want to say about any of that? And do you think your book is also going to be helpful for people to understand what this group is all about?
Absolutely. From the outset, I wrote this book because I wanted people who had come from this world and were making sense of it in some way and maybe didn't feel fully connected to it anymore, but felt like it had shaped them and, you know, that they were trying to think about who they are now in relation to that. That's a lot of people. I meet them everywhere, and I wanted them to feel seen and just sort of validated. And so, yes, I hope that will happen. And I, as the review copies have gone out, I've heard that from a lot of people, that it really mirrors their experience. Because when we all grew up in a similar, or came from a similar subculture, and then made some shift away from it, there is, like any subculture, there are commonalities. And I think that's the piece that will resonate with people. To that second group, people who don't come from the evangelical world and don't think they know much about it, I also hoped from the outset that this would be helpful for them in understanding sort of, you know, I hope it will be empathy building in a way. Like this is what a lot of people believe. This is what they're contending with. This is why I think some of these beliefs, because there is so much fear, it can drive people to do things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise. And I think it's important to understand that. I hope it will be a really useful book for people who are in relationships, you know, whether it's marriage or partnership or close friendship, whatever the case may be, with somebody from the evangelical world, because I really tried to describe in a really granular way what it's like to be inside of it. There's been so much ink spilled about, you know, like the history of white evangelicalism and evangelicalism as a political and social movement. And there a lot of that really valuable scholarship I cite in my book, but I wanted to sort of take people inside and help them understand what it feels like for a lot of us. I hope it will be a helpful sort of conversation starter in that regard.
This last weekend, some friends of mine that were in a Christian rock band in the 90s called Pray for Rain, or PFR, had a reunion concert.
I heard of that.
I don't know if you know who those guys are. And this is
I've
Saturday
heard of them.
Night.
I don't know their music super well, but yes.
Okay. So we had this, they had this kind of, you know, it's been, they broke up in 1996, 97, somewhere in there. So like your teenage years. And I went to the concert, and, you know, we're all in our 50s and stuff. And there was something nostalgic about it, right? Like these songs that I hadn't thought of in decades just came back. And I was remembering being a youth pastor and all this stuff. And there was like this nostalgic fondness for that period. Did you feel any of that when you were writing this book? Like you kind of delved back in and started to think about these things. Were there times in the work on this book that you were like, wow, there's something strange kind of happening in me?
Definitely. I mean, I have to go into churches sometimes for work. And sometimes I find myself like in the corner, like tearing up because the music takes me back. My light just flicked off because this hold on.
Time's
there
up.
We go.
Time's up.
Just trying to save electricity. It's a motion sensor and it wasn't moving enough, I guess. But yeah, I spend a lot of time in, you know, not a lot of time, but some time in churches, and I've definitely had that experience. And then writing it, you know, I found myself, just kind of, it triggered a lot of memories, some good, some bad, but definitely remember one night for some reason going down a rabbit trail and listening to like, do you remember Salty? I mean, this was my generation, but like Salty the Singing Songbook, you know, Salty?
Oh my gosh. Yes. So much. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now the thanks for that. Yeah. They were gone for a while.
So good luck with those earworms or Patch the Pirate.
Yeah.
Do you remember Patch the Pirate? Yeah.
Totally.
So all of that stuff. And then, you know, I definitely had to go back and listen to some Amy Grant, who was, you know, very controversial in her own right. And still is putting out music. But yes, I mean, I think this is something that I hope comes through in the book. There is a lot of pain there when I think about that world, but there's also a lot of love. And that's why part of why the subtitle is what it is. I think that, you know, however someone grows up or wherever they're from, we all have to make peace with who we are and who we were and who we're becoming, you know? And those things are all, those three people are kind of the same person, but they're also different people and they're intertwined. And somebody else I was talking to about the book recently, I said, you know, I think it's really important to like love yourself. And that it means even loving the person that you were, even if it was a person that was struggling with these things and maybe confused and, you know, maybe wasn't the person that you would want to become. But I think part of that is just accepting the good and the bad and sifting through it and being able to appreciate the nostalgic moments, you know, and just being okay with the fact that those exist because they're part of our stories too.
Yeah, and everybody's along that journey. And when you start opening this up, I'm sure you're hearing it already. People just start telling you things about their own struggles at the time. People that you would have thought were hardwired in and had no struggles at all were like, oh no, I was barely holding on. You know, once you start opening this up. There's a philosopher named Ken Wilber. Do you know that name at all? He's big in an area called spiral dynamics. Anyway, it's kind of a
sounds fascinating.
Philosophy thing, but he uses colors to represent different stages of human development and so on. But he has a concept that he refers to as to transcend and include. And his suggestion is that whatever our past be, we have to transcend our past, but we also have to include, because if we don't transcend, we get stuck and then we're not growing. And if we don't include the parts of it that were life-giving to us, then we become narrow and bitter. And it's just been a really interesting way to think about a spiral as a way of development rather than like left and right only. You know, I don't know, that's something you're in movement.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating stuff for people in who've gone through certain spirituality and cultural shifts. But that idea that's what I was hearing when you were describing, like transcending and including your own history. And coming to grips with yourself and forgiving yourself and enjoying yourself and saying, hey, those, you know, I was doing the best, maybe not the best I could, but I was trying to do pretty good, you know, at those, in those times, and I'm working it out now. All right. Just one more question about delving in the past. And then I want to ask you about being a reporter and all. What advice do you have for people that are now just starting this process that you've had a lot of years on and also had the privilege of book thinking about it? And as an author, I know what it means to think about things when you're writing a book, because you have a very particular practice when you're making sentences and chapters have to be the same length roughly. And, you know, you have to order things in a certain way. It really causes you to understand your own ideas in a whole different level. Do you have any advice for people who are just getting started in this process and they feel that start of deconstruction going on?
I kind of get asked this a lot lately, and it's weird for me as a journalist because I never give advice. I never want to tell anybody what to think. but I, you know, I've thought about this a little bit, and I think what I'm most comfortable saying about that is the advice I would have given my younger self, which is to not be afraid of learning, to not be afraid of questions, to try to be humble, you know, to self-reflect. I mean, I think that's one of the valuable things that I was given by evangelicalism, is the sense that you should search your heart and question your own motives. And, you know, we can do that to a fault, to the point where we're constantly second guessing ourselves. But I also think there's value in kind of going, well, why, you know, what is motivating me to do this? What is it that's nagging at me? Where are these questions coming from? And so I think just kind of being open to those conversations with yourself. I wish I would have journaled more in those times, because I think I look back on some of my old journals and I realize that I can almost remember writing them, that I was writing what I felt like I was supposed to write. And I wish that when I started going through kind of my deconstruction process, a lot of it was just in my own mind. And it might've been easier to sort through if I had written a lot sooner. Even just this process of writing the book was clarifying and cathartic. And I'm like, wow, I should have done this more 20 plus years ago. And the last thing is, I felt sometimes when I was earlier in this process, like if I didn't believe the right things and didn't have it all figured out, it was not okay to, I guess, engage in spirituality, if that makes sense. So like I had absorbed this idea that I had to have all the right theology and the right beliefs, or it wasn't real. It wasn't true Christianity. It wasn't therefore meaningful. And so for a long time, you know, I would go to church sometimes, but I would feel really guilty, and I didn't pray a whole lot. I would sometimes, but I just felt like I had this almost icky relationship to prayer. Like, I don't know if I believe in it. I don't know what it is. Yeah. And the more I become at peace with like the process and the journey, the more I don't worry about that. And I actually feel like today I probably pray more than I did when I was more deeply involved in, you know, an official church. And I don't really know why that is, or if it's just because it was sort of what I was trained to do spontaneously. But yeah. I find that when I've sort of relaxed and stopped trying to like make myself think certain things and hold certain beliefs and just kind of allowed it to happen organically, I sometimes surprise myself and I feel more connected to something bigger than myself than I did when I was trying to make it happen. I don't know if that makes sense, but I guess the message is that it's okay to feel spiritual or want to pray or want to talk to God or listen to a worship song, whatever it might be, even if you don't know exactly what it means. You know, I'm not going to let like the pastor whose church I sat in when I was 13 years old tell me what my relationship to God is supposed to look like today and tell me what's authentic and what's not. But that's just, that again would be my advice to myself, because everybody's journey is so unique, and I want to be so respectful of that.
I just listened to a podcast with Anne Lamott and her husband. She has they have a new book out. I don't know if you follow her or them, but she's married to a psychotherapist.
I love her writing. Yeah. It was actually very influential early in my life on the idea that you could be a Christian in a way that looked different than what I was told. But yes.
Totally. Yeah. For sure. Anyway, they have this new book out. They have this podcast. I'll send it to you. I think for this thing, you'd really like it. They talk about having these little gremlins in your mind that have these faces. And she remembers an editor she talks about. And so, you know, saying like that pastor when I was 13, like just that person kind of haunts, you know, and is still around and they're just not in charge anymore. So they have this process where she's like, I just tell them like, hey, I can't deal with you right now. Go sit over there and, you know, maybe I'll call you back in a couple of days, but I can't deal with you right. Like just dealing with it as another personality in her head that she's like, I got to move this thing aside, and taking a lot of, you know, agency in like the thoughts in some, because there's a lot of guilt. Man, I know people who that are maybe in their early 40s and they're like, hey, it's really funny. Like, I've been listening to worship songs when they come on the radio. Like I turn on the Christian radio thing and I'm like, what am I doing listening to this stuff? Like I said no to all of that 15 years ago or 18 years ago. Now I'm kind of like, and they're like, and it's a little guilty pleasure. You know, it's the funniest thing, right? Where they used to listen to secular music as the breakaway. Now they're like, I don't know, every once in a while it's kind of that George Costanza thing from Seinfeld. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's happy music. I kind of like it. It makes me feel good. You know, they're like that. It's really, I just think you're tapping into something that has always gone on. Evangelicalism has always been a transitional thing. You know, it's always had lots of versions, but there is a particular genre of this in the last 30 years that is affecting a lot of things and, you know, a lot of cultural and social and political life in America is affected by all of this. And I think it's a real treat that you brought your journalistic narrative and being willing to share your own personal narrative. I think that's extremely, extremely helpful. Can you just say something about that process in our last couple of minutes? Like what were the struggles and what helped you when you've developed 20 years of journalistic thinking to then this particular project? Like where did that help you? And where was that a hard thing to know when to be which role in your life?
Yeah. You know, it happened pretty organically. I had been thinking about, of course, like I said, these issues for so long and, you know, post 2016, seeing so much more sort of online engagement around these kinds of conversations kind of catalyzed by by the Trump moment, but not limited to, and I think predating it. And so I've been thinking for a long time about sort of like what I might want to say about it. And it really happened organically. I mean, I started writing probably around 2017. I started sort of journaling, just writing down things and moments in my life that had happened that were sort of like these tension points and these moments of cognitive dissonance for me that pushed me to think a little differently. And then I was just paying attention to some of these evangelical and deconstruction spaces and seeing a lot of fascinating conversations happening and thinking about how they fit in with my own experience. And so it took me a few years to sort of like work up the courage to write a book proposal and to kind of think about how I wanted it to feel. But once I started sort of getting the ideas down, I actually started with, I think somewhere I read the suggestion. I started with a bunch of post-it notes and just sort of scribbling down like themes and people and ideas and just like organizing them on my wall. I had this big brick wall at the house I was living in then. And I just would put things in columns and kind of organize them by color and then move them around until something kind of took form. And it kind of felt like I've never sculpted. I'm not an artist at all, but this is an analogy, but a little bit like sculpting, like you're just refining, mm-hmm. refining, refining. And eventually I kind of found the kernel of what I wanted to do, wrote it in a book proposal form, did some reporting, sort of reaching out to people who I had either known in my life or met online or read their books or whatever the case may be. And kind of forming this, like pulling together all these threads. And it really wasn't that different than anything else I do as a journalist, where you're talking to you're looking at data, you're talking to experts, you're interviewing people about their personal stories, you're finding those stories any way you can, and then weaving it together thematically. But this was, much bigger and a much longer process. But to your point earlier, Doug, about writing a book, it is a really different discipline than other types of writing. And I think one of the cool things was that by the end of it, I really felt like, okay, I've just really kind of used myself as one more source, in a much bigger conversation. So,
does it make you feel like I want to keep doing this? Is there something else you're like, hey, this was all right, I want to keep writing? Or are you like marathon runners who are one and done and thinking, nope, don't need to do that again?
No, I definitely want to do it again. And I was actually, that's in line with what I was going to say, but I felt like having the opportunity to spend a lot more time on this one subject and really interact with people's stories in like a longer form way was really rewarding. And yes, I absolutely hope to do it again.
Great. Yeah. How often now in your professional life, when people say, oh, you've got a book coming out, what is it? Or maybe now they already know the title and you say, oh, it's about the ex-evangelicals and I was one of those. Do you get the response of like, really? You grew up in that world? Is that a common response?
Most of my colleagues know that about me now, but I would get it a lot like 6 or 7 years ago. I started talking about this around 2016 because one of my former colleagues who was, ironically enough, who had a podcast about public media, asked me if he could talk to me. I'd written one short post for NPR about what it was like when Prince died in, I think, 2015 or 16, to sort of have this moment of pop culture disconnect, kind of like you talked about earlier. I had all of these friends that were just like distraught. And I think we turned our, like, we had like a purple light shooting up at NPR, in honor of Prince, because the colors can change. And I just remember being like, I think I know a couple of his songs. And, these kinds of things happened a lot for me. Just these reminders of like, I kind of grew up in a different culture, And so I wrote this essay for NPR about it. And it was interesting. I heard from a lot of people, some of whom had grown up in conservative Christian communities, who were like, oh my gosh, this is how it is. And I also heard from a couple of folks who were like first generation American, who said, growing up in the US, but in an immigrant household where we had a different relationship to American pop culture, and we were sort of getting oriented to it. Like, that's how I feel too. I feel like I missed things. And so it was really interesting to me. Like, I think this is one of the beautiful things about writing. Like, it connects you to people sometimes in ways you expect and sometimes in surprising ways, because we are all human, and some of our experiences wind up being really resonant, even if they're not exactly the same experience. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think people know now, but I have over the years gotten some surprise. And that's, again, part of why I wrote the book, is I wanted to answer that question of sort of how did I go from that to who I am today?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad for what you do today. And by the way, whenever you're hosting on, Weekend Edition or something, I'm always more happy. I like the regular host. Sarah's on. It's great. So if you ever wonder if people are happy when you're on, yes, we are. Yes, we certainly
at least
are.
People who know me. So.
Yes. Yeah. And I like your, I like your style. There's a directness to your, to your reporting. I've been on the receiving end of you as a reporter. Yes. And in the way you report, there is a like clarity and directness that's really great, which I'm sure is also a feature of the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Maybe that's being Midwestern, which you can relate to maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Like just say it. Right?
Say it. Yeah. Well,
thank you. Thank you so much for this book. Again, the book is, we'll put the title. Yeah, there it is. The Exvangelicals. By the way, I was at Xfinity today having to get a modem at my house. And I thought of your book, the Xfinity logo.
Oh,
I don't know if you've made that.
Maybe we have.
But I said
co-branding opportunity. No. That's funny. I'm glad you, did you get your modem situated, I hope?
You are using it right now. We are both benefiting from the new modem right now. Yeah, so it's it proof positive that worked. And this is not brought to you by Xfinity, but Xfinity, if you ever want to sponsor what we're doing, please send us any amount of money. And we will talk about you constantly. Glad to do that. In fact, anybody who wants to sponsor, we will be glad to talk about anything you want or for sale.
And you can buy the book while you're at it, right?
Yes. Yes. And so we're recording this before the book is available, but it's out now and you can find it on all the places. And Sarah has written or has recorded an audio version. Do you have another minute to say something about the audio version?
Sure.
Because absolutely. I saw on social media that you had recorded it. How was that for you reading your own words over and over? That is that's its own daunting experience, isn't it?
Well, I wrote on my Substack that I kind of went into the experience like very confident, like, you know, like when you walk into a Spanish one class and you've already taken it in high school and you're taking it in college, you're like, I already aced this. But actually, it's a different skill than public broadcasting. And it's a lot of performance. And also, like, it's a different thing to read an entire book in a week, particularly one that's about your own life. But I will say, it was actually really wonderful to revisit the text. Writing a book, as you know, Doug, is a long process, and you spend a lot of time going back and forth and editing and revising. And so to just sort of spend a week with it start to finish, I felt really excited about it. I'm really excited to share this story with people, whether they want to listen to the audiobook or read it or both. But I will say, next time I write a book, I'm going to make sure that definitely bring cough drops and tea, because those were the only two things that got me through that week. It's a lot of talking, even for somebody who is a broadcaster.
Yeah, it's a lot of talking. And it's surprising, isn't it, how you're reading your own book and you're like, I'd forgotten all about that section, like, or I really liked that section. Like, you have a whole new experience once it's done and edited and then away from you for a while and then comes back and then you're just in it and now you're talking about it. It's a real trip for the writers and the authors. Hey, and by the way, Sarah does have a great sub, which you can get a free version. I think I pay for it, but anyway, get a free.
Actually, there's no paywall at all. I accept payments, but I do not require payments. So I mostly just want to communicate with people and stay in touch.
Yeah. Well, you do a great job. It's also a wonderful mix of personal and professional stuff. So if you're new to Substacks or don't even know what they are, it's kind of like a newsletter, but better. I don't know. It's just better than a letter. Kind of a blog and a newsletter, all my one, right? Is that how you describe it? How you think about it?
Yeah, I think so. That's about right. And I like that, there's space for people to interact and comment. And I found it to be more rewarding, I think, than probably almost any other social media space.
Interesting. Okay, now I'm going to think about doing a Substack. Right now, I'm just on the receiving ends only. That's it. I just read a bunch of them. Well, Sarah, thank you.
I would read your Substack, so if you do it, let me know.
Well, there we go. There we go. One subscriber already. Yeah. Probably worth doing. That's an evangelical side of you, right? If there was just one, it would be worth the whole thing. So I will write a Substack for just the one lost sheep. I'll do it. Sarah, thank you. Thanks for your great spirit, for your friendship, and for this great book, and for all your good reporting, and just the Sarah McCammon of the world. So thanks for being part of it with us.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for your time. Really good to talk to you, always.